so sick of hearing the anti-white message, then you've come to the right place. You're tuned in to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Of the evening, yes, it is approaching the evening now, is Peter Russian, who should not need any introduction, because everybody knows him personally and for what he writes and what his speeches from the past. Now we have him in the future. Take the stage, Peter.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. John Tyndall died 13 years ago, and it's the usual fate of politicians to fade into irrelevance and obscurity in the period immediately following their death, perhaps, if they're lucky, becoming relevant again only a generation or two later, when their legacy is picked over and reassessed by historians. Consider the likes of Margaret Thatcher, Ted Heath, Jim Callaghan and Harold Wilson, the four leading politicians of John Tyndall's era, and the issues once momentous over which they battled: incomes policy, trade unions, even nuclear weapons. Who talks really about such issues today? But in the 13 years since his death, the central issue of John Tyndall's political life has become ever more dominant in the lives of his fellow Britons. And in the consciousness of his fellow Britons, that issue, of course, being the racial transformation of our country, its consequences, and the possibility of a radical nationalist counter-revolution to reverse that racial transformation and repair its consequences. John Tyndall's life spans the period of that transformation. He was born in a white England at the centre of a mighty empire. He was just 5 years old when his country and that empire, by extension, committed itself to a suicidal European civil war. He was 14 years old when the great multiracial experiment began, with the arrival of the troop ship Empire Windrush and its cargo of West Indians. Within John Tyndall's lifetime, his fellow Britons passed through those phases which we know only too well, especially those of us who've been involved in nationalist political campaigning know those phases all too well, where one starts off with no perceptible problem, then there's a problem down the road, or there's a problem in Bradford, but you know it'll never happen here. And then pretty much by the next round of elections, when you're knocking on the door, it's, instead of it'll never happen here, it's, oh well, it's too late now to do anything about it, isn't it? And the whole of John Tyndall's country, the whole of our country, passed through those phases during his lifetime. But JT, of course, rejected such fatalism. And at one time, John Tyndall's position, now of course labelled as a position of extreme haters, of genocidal maniacs, of aspirant terrorists, as we were hearing a moment ago. At one time, John Tyndall's position was not only the common sense position of ordinary Britons, but the expert position of the acknowledged great and the good. Because if you go back to just the year, just 12 months after the Empire Windrush, for example, there was a royal commission on population. Now this was partly because, of course, this was drawn up partly because we'd had two world wars in the space of a generation, and it was acknowledged that that was going to have a eugenic effect. That was going to have an effect that government and that academics needed to address. A short-term effect while people were being demobbed, while young Britons were on the other side of the world or were still under arms, and possibly a long-term effect as well due to losses. So the Royal Commission on Population addressed this issue of immigration, that perhaps mass immigration was going to be necessary for the first time. But significantly, that Royal Commission reporting in 1949 said, immigrants on a large scale into a fully established society like ours could only be welcomed without reserve if the immigrants were of good human stock and were not prevented by their religion or race from intermarrying with the local population and becoming merged with it. Note the assumption there. And we all know that there are certain people whose religious standpoint might lead them not to wish to marry into people of a different race or a different religion. One wonders, for example, what somebody called Afua Hirsch was mentioned earlier on. I do have to wonder what Afua Hirsch's paternal relatives thought about her father marrying a Ghanaian. But it's also assumed here that one might be logically prevented by race from intermarrying with the local population. And this was the assumption of a royal commission in 1949. That races that were totally different would not be either logical or desirable or desired by the members of those races to marry into each other. So eugenics was considered important by that Royal Commission. Racial issues were considered important. But not only by the Royal Commission. In 1945, 4 years earlier, even in the aftermath of the Second World War, which we're now told by the propagandists had killed racism, that dreadful thing, racism, had been killed forever, because even to speak about races and about, or even to speak about culture, even to speak about national heritage, was to conjure up the shadow of mass extermination, were now led to think. But in 1945, immediately after that Second World War, the Fabian Society, a left-wing think tank, published a pamphlet, Population and the People, speaking about immigration and saying that from the population point of view, we need to encourage potential parents of healthy stock to settle in the British Isles and to discourage those whom we already have from leaving. In other words, this thing that we're all familiar with, that when non-European immigrants were flooding in, many of our best and brightest were flooding out in the post-1945 years, seeking opportunities in the white Commonwealth. And the Fabian Society was saying we need to discourage that. And they continued that, in these extraordinary words from a left-wing think tank, and I quote, men and women of European stock between the ages of 20 and 30 are the immigrants best suited to assist population policy. Men and women of European stock, said the Fabian Society. That these people would have to be selected to ensure they were assimilable and could adapt to the British way of life, and the utmost care should of course be taken to admit only those physically and mentally sound and free from criminal records who will introduce a sound stock into the country. And the Fabians concluded the eugenics of immigration cannot be overstressed. The eugenics of immigration cannot be overstressed. So they were quite clear that if you were going to have immigration, it should be soundly racially based, not an open door, still less should it be based, as immigration policy now seems to be, on guilt-ridden obsessions and grovelling, that somehow in order to make amends for the British Empire, we have to admit God knows who from all the corners of the world have to be admitted to our towns and cities. So the political establishment knew that there was a particular problem and that a particular approach to immigration was desirable. They still know. But it's no longer convenient for them to admit it, either because they actively want to destroy our racial and cultural identity, or because they fear to contradict the accepted line, because they are more concerned with their careers than with the well-being of the British people. John Tyndall, of course, also knew throughout his political career the racial realities that should inform immigration policy, but John Tyndall had the courage to continue telling the truth. Political consistency of that kind, ladies and gentlemen, has consequences. It has consequences potentially for people's careers. It has consequences most evident in 2018, not only in Britain but across Europe, in terms of demonisation and criminalisation of those who dare to dissent. Those, because our lords and masters prefer not to confront the actual arguments. They no longer have the honesty of the Fabian Society in 1945 or the Royal Commission on Population in 1949. They're rather like, and it's not just on racial and immigration matters. We've seen just this week an example of how the political elite prefer not to engage with the real arguments at stake. They prefer to raise some demonisation of their opponents. When in relation to Brexit, rather than addressing the issues concerned, we now see the demonisation of Aaron Banks. So Brexit is not something to be regretted, not something to be rethought, not something to be rowed back on because it's wrong or because of some particular undesirable consequence. No. It's because in some way Aaron Banks was a criminal, or in some way Russian money was involved, or any excuse will do, any flag will do, any alarmist approach will do, so long as it serves to demonise your opponents. Now, just 2 weeks ago, I and one or two others present in this room were present at a quite spectacular example of that demonisation and its consequences. When we were hosting a private reception at a hotel in Shepperton by the side of the River Thames, for a man who was born in that very town, born in Shepperton almost 90 years ago, and who time and again, simply because he has dared to confront accepted historical orthodoxy, he has been targeted not only in the courts, dragged before the courts, but set upon while walking near his home. Set upon and beaten while walking near his home. And on what was to turn out to be the last weekend of his life, just two weeks ago, that man, Professor Robert Forison, was returning to his hometown, to his native town in Shepparton. Towards the end of his speech to an invited audience, including one or two people here present, the management arrived, called me outside. Well, guess what happened next? Not with any objection to the way any of the people present had behaved. You know, these retired academics and their family and friends, they weren't behaving like rock stars and smashing up the hotel. They weren't causing any difficulties of any sort. But the hotel had been telephoned by the usual suspects, saying, "Oh, you have a meeting of thought criminals here." And significantly, while to begin with, the hotel said, "Well, you know, what of it? They've made a booking in the normal manner." The hotel were then had extra phone calls saying, "We're sending down strange phrase that I wasn't familiar with, but the bookings manager said, "Oh, they've phoned up and said that there's a gang of crystal meth heads going to be sent down to smash up the hotel." Crystal meth heads, that's a curious phrase. So, but these characters, these self-described violent drug-fueled criminals, were supposedly on their way down, and instead of either calling the just telling them to bugger off, or just calling the police and saying, "Look, these violent criminals are saying they're coming down here," the response of the hotel was to say, "Oh, you must close down this event immediately and leave." Now, of course, we took the view that we'd paid for a meeting that was going to go on until 5 o'clock, and so we're going to go on with a meeting that was going to continue till 5 o'clock, which we did. But the response of the hotel was to set the fire alarms off and to make enormous rackets to try and drown us down.
Turn the lights off.
Leave us in darkness. Yeah. So we continued as best we could, because we were not, as Eddie Morrison said about John Tyndall over all those years, we were not going to submit. We were not going to accept that in our own country, drug-fueled maniacs can tell us when our meeting ends. We say when our meeting ends, not some bunch of criminals on the telephone who are afraid even to give their name. Now, Robert Forison is, or should I say now was, a quite exceptional example of that, just as John Tyndall was, of that refusal to toe the line, that refusal to submit to legal or physical bullying. And those of you who weren't there, or as a souvenir, those of you who were, will be no doubt be interested to see the video that's now with extreme rapidity being edited and put together by Michelle and our friends on the first two speeches on that day. It has to be said, the third speech, my own speech, will have to be reconstructed for the cameras, since the background bedlam of rock music, banging plates and fire alarms might make it a little wearing for repeated viewing on a DVD.
But the most determined speech of the
so that will be reconstructed for a subsequent DVD and is going to be brought out in a short while as part of a tribute to Robert Forison. But Michelle has a very limited number. I think one's already gone to Mrs. Jordan, hasn't it, Michelle?
Yeah, so two are
going into the raffle. Those are the only three at the moment that exist.
They are the first
issues of that DVD, and that will be in the raffle later on. Of course, uh, and as many of you will know, in an extraordinary triumph of mind over matter, Robert Faurisson, having completed his speech, having enjoyed his weekend in his native town, joined us for breakfast the morning after, then went caught his flight home, eventually got back to Vichy, to his home there, opened his front door, collapsed on the doorstep, dead in front of his wife, immediately after returning on the day after that meeting at the age of 89, would have been 90 in January. What an extraordinary man Robert Faurisson was, and his legacy will live with us for the rest of our lives, and I'm sure will live with future generations. But of course, not only in France, but across Europe, and most particularly in Germany, people are locked up. Again, a lady who I think will be 90 very shortly, Ursula Haferbeck.
Got her card to you, by the way, I'll tell you later.
Oh, splendid. Mm-hmm. We'll hear more about Ursula at the very end of the meeting. She is currently incarcerated in Germany. Horst Mahler, well into his 80s, having had part of his leg amputated, remains in prison in Germany. And here, lest we think that this is some continental disease, you know, in the great tradition of British isolationism, when there was used to the supposed headline in the London Evening Standard, "Fog in Channel, Continent Cut Off," that somehow we are exempt from what goes on in the rest of Europe. We, of course, are not exempt, because, as has been mentioned a few moments ago, our friend Jeremy Bedford Turner, Jez Turner of the London Forum, remains in prison in Sutton, where I visited him on Wednesday this week just gone. He's in fine form, but nonetheless quite outrageous that people are to be locked up in medieval fashion, just as people were locked up for seditious libel, for saying something that was deemed offensive by the king. Now people are locked up for things that are deemed offensive by the politically correct establishment. Where on earth is this going to end? And those of us who wonder about whether about how far our political establishment is prepared to go in concocting a case against its perceived enemies, I'll give just one example drawn from my speech a fortnight ago, that in the early years of the Second World War, in November 1941 to be specific, a memorandum labelled "Most Secret" was sent from Canada to the headquarters of the Special Operations Executive in London on the subject of what was termed atrocity photographs. Its author was an Englishman called Eric Mashwitz, who was a famous pre-war songwriter, author of a song called "A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square," and another song appropriately titled "These Foolish Things," who was at this stage in the autumn of 41, this of course was the purpose of all of this was to bring the Americans into the war, because this was a few weeks before Pearl Harbor, and they didn't necessarily know that Pearl Harbor was going to happen, or that it was definitely going to happen. So throughout 41, a great propaganda effort was underway, and as part of that, Eric Mashwitz was running a special forgery factory for SOE in Toronto, Canada, in a handily situated place where things could be smuggled across the border into the States or elsewhere. Now, in November, he was on a short trip to London to receive further instructions and finance as part of this British propaganda effort. And in this document, the original of which I've read in the National Archives at Kew in London, Mashwitz informed his superiors, quote, "With reference to our recent conversation on atrocity photographs, I've given some thought to the matter and have come to the following conclusions. If asked to do so, my section could quite easily provide a regular supply of atrocity pictures manufactured by us in Canada, because existing pictures available from occupied territory are so indifferent in quality that it would be useless to attempt to use these as a basis for fakes, and that therefore we should make entirely new photographs using models, etc. Any scheme for a regular supply of pictures would require the full-time services, he says, of a first-class photographer and darkroom man, and of someone with the right talents and experience to devise, pose and supervise the pictures. And speaks about the various technical people he could get in Canada, but he said, I'm doubtful about finding the right impresario, his word there. And I feel that if the scheme is approved, we should arrange to send someone out on the job, preferably someone of an imaginative nature who has had film studio experience. And this would involve the buying and hiring of costumes, the manufacture of small pieces of scenery and dummies, the part-time services of a first-class makeup man, etc., all of which should be, for safety, carried out under some sort of cover. And he says that he can get the cooperation of the head of the Canadian Mounted Police, and significantly of a man called John Grierson, who was an important documentary filmmaker in that era, but who also turned out later on had a close connection to communist spy rings, which might not have been coincidental. But anyway, and he concludes that, that for the sake of accuracy, we should have as complete a library as possible of photographs of German personnel, equipment, vehicles, etc. If possible, we should also have actual specimens of German steel helmets, equipment, weapons, etc., to serve as models. And that we need to get on with this, he said, because it's November 41 now. We need to get on with this as soon as I return to America, because the most obvious theoretical setting for these atrocity pictures at the moment is Russia. So we should get to work while there's still snow in Canada, so that it looks like Russia. And what an extraordinary business that was.
Who was the guy that was sent out?
They eventually sent out a guy called a Captain Ellis, who'd had film studio experience, to work with Mashvitz on that. Yeah,
really interesting.
What an extraordinary story.
And
it was.
They sent Billy Wilder out at the end of the war.
Yes, eventually at the end of the war, Billy Wilder and Alfred Hitchcock were involved in similar projects at the end of the war. But this was as early as November 1941. Mm. Now, the question, of course, is where do we go next? And here we go to the other side of John Tyndall's legacy, that we've heard about tenacity, we've heard about courage, we've heard about ideological consistency, but also it's important to stress John Tyndall's faith in the political process and his faith, ultimately his faith in the British people, which in a way mirrored Sir Oswald Mosley's faith in the British people. When Mosley was asked in a pre-war booklet, he was asked, "Will you ever need to do something like the Nuremberg laws or whatever bring in laws to preserve British racial stock?" And he said, "Worry you, that sort of thing's not going to be necessary in Britain, because although we have this mighty empire, we don't have much interracial breeding within it." And he said, I don't really think the British people would want to do that sort of thing. They can see that would have undesirable consequences and they wouldn't do it. Of course, that was the case in Sir Oswald Mosley's day. What he didn't realise was the extent of cultural propaganda that would be pushed at the British people, so that girls on estates in England now think it's the bee's knees to get involved in interracial relationships. In Mosley's time, he felt it was self-evidently obvious that it wouldn't happen. But nevertheless, throughout the 1960s, for example, never less than 80% of those polled, never less than 80%, made it clear they wanted an end to non-white immigration into this country. And although a large proportion of the British people might now be afraid to say that to a pollster, they weren't afraid, for example, to vote for Brexit. This was, in a sense, the expression of their dissent from the prevailing consensus. And all of the people who voted for Brexit weren't turning out to vote on that because they shared the particular single-minded obsession with the European issue that characterised many members of UKIP. On balance, they might have agreed, but they weren't obsessed about that issue. The reason they were so keen to flood to the ballot box to vote for Brexit in such huge numbers, especially in areas like this, why Indigenous Britons were so keen to do that, is that this was their chance to fight back. This was their chance to be heard. This was their chance not simply to be ignored by the political elite. Because the system, the circumstances of that Brexit referendum meant, at least they thought, they couldn't be ignored. Of course, the political elite is trying its best to ignore them and reverse it now. But nevertheless, it was a chance to rebel. The fact of that victory as well is particularly important for racial nationalists. Not necessarily because Brexit itself will be some sort of panacea from a racial point of view. I've no doubt that even as we speak, there are many people that will be seeking to skew post-Brexit immigration policy so that it might even be worse than immigration policy while we're inside the European Union. No doubt about that at all. No, the important thing, the really important thing for us as racial nationalists strategically, is that that Brexit victory gave the lie to the fatalistic approach, to the conspiracy theory approach, to the defeatist approach that said, oh, whatever we do, whoever they might be, are in control. We will never, the British people will never be able to do anything via the ballot box. The British people will never be able, racial nationalists will never be able to do anything by means of normal politics. We'll have to have a revolution, we'll have to have whatever, whatever. All the defeatist arguments that are heard 1,000 times a day in internet chat rooms. All of that was contradicted by that Brexit result. Because if they were pulling the strings to such an extent that nothing we do could make any difference, it would have been the easiest thing in the world in what was an inherently close referendum to swing it their way. The fact is, they were not in control. The British people did make their voice heard, and in fact, it could be argued that they, in quotation marks, are less in control now than they've been at any time since 1945. We've seen Angela Merkel forced to step down. We've seen all the many rebellions loosely described by journalists as populist. We've seen the many rebellions that Jim Luthwaite referred to earlier on today. We've seen the multifaceted cultural rebellions that Steve Frost referred to earlier today. And so I think it's very important in that context that whatever our problems as a movement, and John Tyndall certainly saw many of those in his career, saw split after split, was knocked down and had to get back up again, had to pick himself up, dust himself down, and start the fight all over again. It's very, very important that the old hands, as it were, shouldn't allow the new generation of nationalists to become trapped into needless, pointless, over-the-top extremism, illegality and self-sacrifice. Because, let's face it, they won't just be sacrificing themselves in terms of getting themselves locked up with loose talk in the pub or loose talk on Facebook. They'll be because they are the younger generation, some of them the brightest and best of the younger generation of nationalists, they won't just be sacrificing themselves, they'll be sacrificing our cause as well. Yeah. Let's not let them do that. Let's not. And, you know, and let's be clear about it, there is no terrorist conspiracy. There is no uprising where somehow all of these youngsters are going to take up arms and be the vanguard of a racial nationalist revolution. It's not going to happen. What there is desperate, loose talk by understandably desperate, embattled and sometimes clinically depressed individuals who find themselves easily trapped by the forces of the establishment, and now that MI5 are in charge rather than just PC Plod, they'll be even more easily trapped into incriminating themselves and into being labelled as terrorists. Our job, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chairman and racial comrades, our job is to show them a better way. Not necessarily, as Steve Ross correctly said earlier on, that better way is not necessarily at this point, today, tomorrow or next week, to pull a rabbit out of the hat or to pull some piece of paper out of my pocket with the constitution of a new and perfectly formed movement that's going to incorporate everybody of goodwill in racial nationalism. That in the short term is not going to happen. In the long term, in the medium to long term, something of that sort will have to happen. But in the meantime, certainly the steady chipping away, the revelation, the steady revelation of truth, the steady undermining of lies, all of those things, the giving, the passing on of a good example to the younger generation, all of those things are fantastically important. But it's now 13 years after John Tyndall's death, and in a few days' time 100 years since the end of Europe's suicidal civil war. The best tribute to John Tyndall, the best tribute to the fallen, the best tribute to those countless generations across millennia, as Mike Whitby would say, across millennia of Britons and millennia of white Europeans, the best tribute to all of those people is to make what contribution we can towards building the resistance, towards the beginning of a slow but steady but already perceptible, this is important, not some fantasy vision, not some comforting words, but to make our contribution to that process that is already perceptible and which John Tyndall would so dearly have loved to be here with us today to see himself and to write about in Spearhead, how marvellous it would have been for him to be here to see the crumbling of that of the oppressors of Europe, the crumbling of the anti-European rulers of Europe. The best tribute to all of those people is to begin the process of rebuilding a Europe for Europeans, a Britain for Britons, a country, a continent, and a world for our people, that future generations of our people can grow up in safety and in pride. Thank you very much.
Anti-white system. Be tuned to the pro-white system. Radio Air.